dress. Oh, but while I'm weary, try a little tenderness.
Picture Chicago, the city of blues, black market booze, speakeasies, gangsters and hustlers. From Al Capone to Dillinger, Raymond Chandler and Philip K. Dick, home of the Blues Brothers, this is Sweet Home Chicago. This is the Windy City, where you walk with your collar up, the crunch of dirty snow is underfoot, and there's that sound of a distant freight train.
Try a little tenderness.
I'm taking you to the early 1940s. We're in the Delisa Club. A young Mildred Cummings from Dayton, Ohio, is barefoot in the spotlight. She sits on the edge of the stage and sings Try a Little Tenderness, and she's wearing that same old shabby dress.
So long, hope we'll meet again someday.
I'm Selena Godden. I'm a poet and an author, and this is the story of Little Miss Cornshucks, how she captivated her live audiences and how she has captivated me.
Darling, I was wrong.
Ahmet Ertegun, the trailblazer who started the rhythm and blues revolution, said she was the best blues singer he'd ever heard. But I think she's probably the best blues singer you've never heard. I want to find out who she was and why we don't know her name. But we start, as every good story should start, with a drink, with a friend. And for me, this adventure all began with a conversation with man about town, Cockney poet Tim Wells. Now, do you remember when you first told me about Little Miss Cornshucks?
I do. It was about 10 years ago. And I gave you an article about her in a magazine called No Depression.
I mean, ever since you gave me that article, I never forgot her. Like, she's someone that I talk about at 3 a.m. when I'm drunk at parties in kitchens, trying to just find anyone that's heard of her. What would you do if you were me and you had to find out more about Little Miss Cornshucks?
What I do know about her, she's from Dayton, Ohio, and she cut a lot of records in Chicago. So I guess I would go to Chicago.
Is that a dare? Are you daring me to go to Chicago?
Yes.
The Chicago.
The Chicago.
Okay, that's
Illinois.
A dare. I'm going. In Chicago, cab drivers and waitresses all tell me that this winter has been brutal. But today the sun has come out and everyone has a spring in their step, including me. I'm heading to the notorious Buddy Guy's Legends Bar in downtown Chicago. A blues joint where they serve cold beer, hot spicy wings and live music. Inside it is dripping with memorabilia, classic guitars and sepia photographs of icons of jazz and blues heroes. I'm going to meet Barry Mazur. For me, he is at the heart of the Cornshucks story because over 10 years ago, he penned that article which Tim Wells gave me to read. It was in a magazine for fans of roots and blues, and his article was called A Soul Forgotten. Now, look at all these beautiful photographs of Little Miss Cornshucks. That's just amazing.
Yeah, the actual
photos.
Whoa! Full set.
I'm actually touching an actual Cornshucks, actual photo.
That is Mildred Joyman and her husband Cornelius.
And we've got Little Miss Cornshucks with her. All really memorable, that big smile. It's always that big cheesy smile, which I really love. And I just think she looks like such a laugh. I've got this thing that I believe that Little Miss Cornshucks is someone that you discover through Chinese whispers. So who told you about Little Miss Cornshucks? Do you remember?
I was reading things on the history of soul music, on the history of blues, on the history of jazz, all these things. And when you got to the 40s, especially in this town, in Chicago, there would be constant references to him. These would be people as remote from each other, seemingly, as the avant-garde jazz guy Sun Ra. And the next thing you know, it's Johnny Ray, a white pop singer from the early 50s, you know, say they love this singer, you know, Miss Cornshucks was very big, or Little Miss Cornshucks. And I would see enough reference to her, I said, well, who is this?
Yeah.
There's no records, there's no stories, I don't know biographies of her, and, you know, who is it?
Well, I woke up this morning and had tears rolling down.
I talked to Barry for hours. He'll be back later. But first we're going on an all-American road trip because I'm going to introduce you to Francie Roulette and her daughter Tanya. Little Miss Cornshucks was born Mildred Cummings in 1923, and she was Francie's mother and Tanya's grandmother. Sadly, Mildred died in Indianapolis, Indiana, in 1999, but she was surrounded by her family. Now it's a four-hour drive from Chicago to Indianapolis, with Lake Michigan all blue on the horizon. Let's take Route 65 and head south.
I was cooking dinner for y'all.
Oh.
Yeah, I had to fix something.
I'm Selena.
For you. Hi,
Selena. Wow, what a beautiful house.
Thank you.
So let's go back right to the very beginning. What can you tell me about Little Miss Cornshucks, Mildred, as a little girl? What was her upbringing like?
Well, they were very poor. And my grandfather, he had four girls, and he trained their voices. And my mother, she was the youngest. They used to go to the talent show. Mm-hmm. And the Cummings girls would always win the talent show. So everybody would come to the talent show because the Cummings was going to be there. One of my aunties got pregnant, so Ma, she said, I can do it. So they put her up there, and my mother just tore down the house. They said, Miss Cummings, that little one of yours, she's going to make it because she's got talent. My grandfather, he wanted all of them to be in show business. But my mother's the only one that went. She's the only one that filled his dream. I mean, she met my dad. Okay, that's a funny story. She was a kid, but she still was singing and everything. They fell in love, and they hadn't even, it was about 15 or 14 of them. And they called me a bush baby because they got me in the bushes.
What?
And my,
oh,
they got, that's a new one.
When mommy sings her lullaby.
Little Miss Cornshucks turned up in Chicago as a fully formed act, apparently out of nowhere, and she was not much more than 20 years old. I'm fascinated by this world Cornshucks entered and performed in. I mean, what was a speakeasy really like?
I'm Lester Goodman. I've danced at the Lisa here in Chicago. I'm 98 years old. So you see, I go back.
My name is Floyd Webb. I'm an independent filmmaker in Chicago, and I'm doing a documentary about Club Delisa.
The Delisa, at first, was on the west side of the street,
right,
in the 55th block. And it was small, but it caught a fire and burned to the ground. Across the street was a garage. The very next night, it opened. And there, in the middle of the floor, being a garage, there was this hydraulic press that used to raise the cars up. And at showtime, they would lift the hydraulic press, and it would raise the stage. So
amazing.
The Chicago clubs were black and tan, meaning integrated. You couldn't say integrated, but you could say. But the stories of the people who were at the Club Delisa, Frank Sinatra used to hang out there as a kid, right? That's where he met Sammy Davis Jr. That's where the friendship began.
Oh, really?
At the Club Delisa. Red Fox used to have a junk band. He had a junk band. He played like washtub bass outside the club. You know, you would have entertainment outside the club before people went into the club.
Amazing.
You know, it's just an amazing history.
And I think also the success of the Club Delisa was that it never closed from the time of the fire, opening up the very next night. They closed for 1 hour to clean up. It never closed.
That is my kind of club.
Never. I mean,
Lisa told me that they never had a lock on the door because they were open 24 hours.
Right.
And people would come from work, they would come from the factories, and they would have breakfast. You could have a breakfast concert. A lot of musicians would be up all night, and they'd have, you know, they'd come and have a morning jam session.
Here's Barry.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that movie, Paris Blue? Mm. Paris Blues. So were the clubs a bit like that?
Well, that was more sophisticated than some of these places. Some of these places were really dangerous. Dives, drugs. I mean, there was prostitutes, there was drugs, there was booze. All of this was the kind of club. Gambling. Time and time again, the people I talked to who were there, who worked there, they said, well, it was the kind of place where you could buy anything, You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They mean anything. This was not quite, you know, the underworld, but it was, and a lot of these were gangster involved. You know, Louis Armstrong had played in clubs where everybody knew. You know, Chicago has its history.
You're reminding me of Mae West again, because she used to love to go to those sort of bars.
That's where she
learned the shimmy.
This is where raucous American music came out of. The shimmy did. I mean, it doesn't come out of elegant, quiet places.
No.
I'd like a rum and coke, please.
Rum and coke.
Thank you.
Picture Al Capone and Dillinger and a smoking gun. Richard Wright, the outsider, and native son. The black and white, the black and tan and blue. The Delisa Club and the rum boogie too. I'm dreaming of Chicago, old time blues. Southside, downtown, walking in their shoes. The colors, the whispers, the smokes, the lights. I'm a jazz ghost hunter in the Chicago night. I'm at the Kingston Mines, a notorious Chicago joint up on the north side, to check out some of the finest electric blues. But Cornshucks, at the Club Delisa, now that's my idea of booze and blues heaven. You've got incredible cocktails, heart-stopping live music, a 24-hour party populated by all kinds of glamorous people, from boxer Joe Louis and Mickey Rooney to jazz greats, music lovers and factory girls. So, in amongst all of that is this singer called Little Miss Cornshucks. What can you tell me about Mildred Cummings?
Oh, I remember she came on and she looked like a little country girl. Back there, they wore these dresses with the little puff on the sleeve here.
Yeah.
And then she'd have a white apron tied around her, bare leg and bare foot, and pretty legs and feet.
Everyone says she has pretty legs and feet.
Yes, yeah, oh yes.
She used to lift her skirt up and let people peek, right? She was a real, really comic about it.
One thing I've been told, or I've pictured as well, is this kind of the ability to sort of walk on stage and sort of almost act like she doesn't know she's on stage, just picking her nose and like as if she's been pushed on stage.
Which, of course, is absolutely polished.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of kind of like Edith Piaf, that kind of lost vulnerability, and also a little bit Charlie Chaplin, like a kind of tramp, kind of really poor,
absolutely.
Down on my heel,
yeah,
but I'm the good guy down on my heel.
Look, you know, we're sitting here in Chicago in a blues club. The people who came to blues clubs in Chicago were almost all people in what's called the Great Migration, were black people who moved from the South North for better jobs and worked in factories. And this is like big city 1940s post-war Chicago.
Yeah.
And you don't want people to latch on that maybe that's who your mother was. And maybe when you were a little kid, that's who you were. People didn't want to be associated with being a hick. She cracked through that with this stuff.
I had a man, faithful and true. I let him die to be.
Francie, as a little girl, would go to Chicago with her grandmother to see her mother perform, peeking around the backstage curtain, watching Mildred transform into Little Miss Cornshucks.
Then they would throw money. She'd pick up money with her toes. She had her basket. What the basket was for, it was for her tips.
Oh, okay.
And she would pick the money up. She had some beautiful feet. She'd pick them up, put it in the basket. She could cry at a drop of a hat. She could make herself
Fine
cry. But you know what? But some of it was sad. She would cry because of things that happened in her life. You know, like this one song about my dad. One is so long.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these were talking to my dad, I believe. You know.
Now that I'm free, you turned your back on me.
So anyway, when she come on stage, she would be sitting down with her legs crossed like this.
Yeah.
And Mama would sit there. And one time when I was over there with her, they had me to come out and sit down like this. She sang to me. And my mother had the beautiful dimples and she was just smiling at me and singing. Then I backed off of the stage and she went on to her act. She got on up off the floor, got her basket. The music started. She said, okay, let's go. That's what she would do. And then she'd be singing. Then she'd stop in the middle of everything. And then she would start crying about certain songs. She used to save all her tips. And she would give me all those. She would come to visit me. My mother was wonderful.
As Francie describes her mother, I'm starting to think that this act was not just a gimmick, it was a provocative statement. In the shadow of segregation and the shame of slavery, this might have subconsciously reminded some of the white members of the audiences to think about their own prejudices. I can see her there playing out the stereotype of uneducated, poor coloured girl, and imagine her having the audience in peals of laughter. It's a great vehicle, because once you make a crowd laugh, you can make them care. And once they care, you can make them cry. Just as she had the audience in the palm of her hand, she'd sing her heart out, showing just how vulnerable and how hurt she really was, and melting every single person in the room. Corn Shucks was in demand. She was touring. And when she was away, the club owners of Chicago missed her. Soon, a very similar act appeared on their bills. She was called Little Miss Sharecropper. And later, she became Laverne Baker. Now, imitation might be the sincerest form of flattery, but in show business, it leads to confusion. And confusion waters down your currency. Laverne Baker wasn't the only one to have been influenced by her. Step up Ruth Brown, the Queen of Rhythm and Blues.
So long. Hope we'll meet again someday.
Ruth Brown was playing in clubs around that same Washington, D.C., Norfolk, Virginia area where Ahmet Erdogan first saw Miss Cornchucks. He's not recorded anybody. He was the Turkish ambassador's son. But he was 19. And he was just, guess what, Dad? Instead of college, I'm going to be making blues records. And they formed Atlantic Records on $500 that he borrowed from their dentist or something. So at that time, who he wanted to record first was Mildred, but they didn't even have the money to go to Chicago or find her. But they knew this singer that was working in New York named Ruth Brown. They called Atlantic Records the house that Ruth built. Not for nothing, for the sheer smash success that was going to happen. But he said to me, I said, you ever heard her first record? Well, her first record is So Long, which is Miss Cornchucks' theme song. And he said, does it even sound like her? We were just doing an imitation Miss Cornchucks record. And the first Ruth Brown hit was So Long, singing like Miss Cornchucks. And Ruth said to me, she was much more blunt about it than Ahmet was. She said, I stole that from her and it should have been her hit.
We could only mean goodbye. We'll just say so long. All alone.
Life, I just didn't like how they treated my mother. You know, they mistreated my mother pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And Mama, she dropped out of show business because I think she started drinking, you know, mm-hmm. and her and Daddy done broke up. And you know, it was just, it just wasn't nice. But she still worked every now and then, you know.
Do you think she really aspired to be like a really big star? Did she? Is that what she really mm-hmm. wanted? Yeah, mm-hmm. just like anyone who, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. such talent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of copycats, huh? Because there was the Ruth Brown.
But she couldn't get it. Yeah. You see, because the reason why they can't get my mother's sound, because she had asthma. She took breaths. So nobody can get it. She had a nasal problem. She told me, said, Frank, they can't copy me. And she said, I'm not a singer, I'm an artist.
Quite a few other people that she influenced along the way up to this day. And I listened to Amy Winehouse, yeah. and she kind of has that sound. And I'm like, I wonder, did she ever get to hear her music? It's just amazing that she really did have a lot of influence and didn't really get her just dues.
I may be weary. Women do get weary. Wearing the same shabby dress.
Not only did Little Miss Cornshucks captivate Ahmet Erdogan, but Barry can link her act to Judy Garland and the jump blues artist Johnny Ray. And her version of the song Try a Little Tenderness preceded famous versions by two soul heroes. Russell Davis, a broadcaster, writer and expert in the American and British songbook, told me more over a cup of tea in his North London kitchen.
So, Little Miss Cornshucks, how did she change the song? Is there any particular part of that song that you feel that she made hers?
Well, her first version from, what is it, 1951, is really a sort of cry from the heart. It's very bluesy and very gospely. And those pauses are dramatic in a sort of preachy way that gospel does use. Aretha Franklin had her own hit with it. As you'd expect from Aretha Franklin, it had that gospel content to it. Otis Redding built his version on the Cornshucks, at least the way it starts out. It starts relatively low-key and quite hymn-like. Again, it's full of soul, and that's what she has too, and feeling, which moved everybody.
I may be sentimental. I have my griefs and my cares. A little word that's soft and gentle makes it easier to bear.
The story of Little Miss Cornshucks is one of bad luck, bad management and missed opportunities. She recorded for several labels, some of them names you might know, like Decca and Chess Records, but she never had a hit. Here's Barry.
No one label had ever supported her enough to do anything for her. All kinds of singers had used what she did and got rich. She didn't. And there was no management at all. And the records, you could see, you can go back in Billboard and look, and they would get good reviews. They would say, this is a good one. But nobody was pushing them. Nobody was following up. There was, Lord knows, no payola to get Miss Cornshucks on the record. And she was the kind of person who needed management and support. If there had ever been a really strong manager, we might be talking a different story today, but she never got one. And everybody agrees that she came to drink too much. There are stories. Ruth Brandt tells them, but they're repeatedly told.
I think a lot of artists self-sabotage when they're getting really close to their dream. Do you think she...
I have no doubt there was some of that.
Yeah.
But some of it was unlucky. The personal life things were hitting at the very time that she had her opportunities. Yeah. And she didn't get many second chances.
No backup, either from a label or in her personal life.
And the father of her children, Cornelius Joyman, you know, like a lot of these guys, I mean, he was living off her. That's the way people describe him. And his unsavory, I mean, that was Ahmet Erdogan's description of him. He was this unsavory character. And he was a womanizer. She bought him a Cadillac.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
He was running off with the money and taking advantage. And pretty much broke her heart. They were flighty young people. You gotta remember, they were both young.
Yeah.
That may help people get a picture, and it didn't go well.
But that one was like at a club she was singing at too, Mom. That one.
Yeah. Kind of, I think she really sounds like she's really singing from her heart. She picked a lot of those songs because they were kind of narrating what she was going through.
Mm-hmm. You can just feel the emotion in her voice, and you know she had to go through most of that she's singing about. So she had a lot of heartache, and you can hear it. There's one song, it brings me to tears, Teasing Round With Me. Mm-hmm. If you listen to that, that's her life. That's mm-hmm. the way she really thought, teasing around with her feelings or just taking her for granted, mm-hmm. basically. That's what made her sad. But the world, they got to see the best part of her, though, when she sang.
I don't want nobody teasing around with me. Oh, yeah, I don't want nobody teasing around with me. I may be weak.
Outside my hotel room in downtown Chicago, the weather has suddenly turned cold. Snow is falling thick and fast. Richard Wright, author of one of my all-time favourite American novels, The Outsider, he lived here in Chicago too. And as I sit at this desk, it feels that his novel and the life of Little Miss Cornshucks are somehow connected. Outsiders are, by definition, outside of the box, and they are most often undiscovered or misunderstood.
Yeah.
It's a sad tale. Mildred Cummings. She died penniless and practically unknown. In other words, like a true outsider. But I reckon it's the outsider that everybody wants to be.
Picture Al Capone and Dillinger and a smoking gun.
True renegades, raconteurs and outsiders document our times, narrating our present from a clear perspective, unsullied by fashion and always ahead of the zeitgeist. If you are an outsider, a bold soul, a true heart, I can picture you now. You're sitting, swinging your legs on the edge of the stage. You are just like Little Miss Cornshucks. You're singing your heart out, sharing your stories and poetry, giving everybody a glimpse of your world from the outside.
And I picture Little Miss Cornshucks wearing that same old shabby dress. You know she's waiting, just anticipating for a thing she'll never possess. Love, her only happiness. Try a little tenderness.
Oh, but while I'm waiting, try a little tenderness.
You've been listening to Try a Little Tenderness, The Lost Legacy of Little Miss Cornshucks, presented by me, Selena Godden, and produced by Rebecca Maxted. It's a Wise Buddha production for the BBC World Service.